This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
On Radio EcoShock, March 2019, Sean Chamberlain told us about the amazing lean logic provided by the late UK alternative economist David Fleming. It points to a way out, a path to a future you would actually like to live in. Now Sean is back with a big release this March. The Keystone is a new film called The Sequel, What Will Follow Our Troubled Civilization. It was created by an award-winning British director and based on the work of David Fleming. Sean advises groups from Chelsea Green Publishing to the UK Department of Energy and Climate Change. He co-authored a report to Parliament and co-founded Transition Town Kingston. Sean heads the Fleming Policy Centre and continues his seminal blog, Dark Optimism.
Radio EcoShock.
Your new film, and really the whole essence of David Fleming's logic, it seems to me, is that we can create a happier, more human sequel to our sorry state of affairs. But to have a sequel, something has to end. Sean, do you think something is ending now?
Yes. I think a lot of things are ending now. I think, I often go back to this line by William Gibson, the science fiction writer, who said, the future's already here, it's just unevenly distributed. And I think there's a shrinking circle of affluence in which people can still sit around and say, you know, where's your apocalypse then, mate? We're in a situation where unthinkable numbers of wild creatures, non-humans, are dying. You know, we've lost more than half the wild vertebrates on Earth over the last 50 years. And the majority of people on Earth are living in increasingly dire circumstances. So it's pretty clear to me that this is the sort of dominant global system is one that, I don't know if on the last legs is enough of a statement, but is falling over as we speak. And as you say, one of the beauties of David's work is not that he's saying, hey, we can make all this good and collapse isn't going to happen and it's all going to be fine. But it's saying as much, if not more, about what we've lost already and stand to regain as about what we've stand to lose. And the fact that, you know, instead of desperately trying to preserve a system that seems to be preserving the wealthy people in actually unhappy circumstances with huge rates of depression and mental illness and suicide and everything else, and destroying the ability of life on Earth to continue in order to support that, we can definitely do something a lot better than that. So it's not necessarily that the future's going to be more materially affluent or comfortable than the present, but it could be an awful lot better than the future we're currently headed towards.
Well, for openers, would you explain David's idea of carnival?
Wow, that's a big question. I would say that the essence of David's economics, because he was a historian and an economist, is that growth, economic growth, is not something that can continue indefinitely. I don't think we need to get into the reasons for that too much in this particular talk. But then he was like, okay, so then we're in this impossible situation. We've got an economic system that's completely based on economic growth. And if we keep growing, then we're going to completely overwhelm the ecological limits of our planet. If we don't keep growing, our system's going to collapse, but that's going to happen either way. So what he asked was, well, what's going to come after that inevitable collapse? He didn't think that we were going to see some, you know, huge ecological consciousness awakening and everyone was going to reduce their consumption and the whole green dream. He sort of worked on that for 10 or 20 years back in the 70s and 80s and didn't see that it was going to happen. So his question was, given where we're headed, what will come after? And he looked historically at, well, how did humanity thrive on this planet for hundreds of thousands of years before economic growth and market-based growth? And essentially, his answer was, before economic growth, what sustained human well-being, and indeed non-human well-being, was culture. That as people participated in communal activities, including very much so carnival, that created the relationships and the grounding for mutual support and continuing thriving. I mean, his books, Surviving the Future and Lean Logic, explain in beautifully written detail how that works as an economic system. But essentially, he's arguing that it was things like carnival that provided the alternative to growth before growth became totally dominant and will inevitably provide what's left afterwards. Because as we all know, when you fall on hard times financially, when you can no longer look for your security in money, what we do as people, as communities, is we inevitably start relying on our relationships again. That's what always has caught people as financial security falls away, and it will do again in the future. So his focus on community and conviviality and carnival is not just, you know, an answer to this sort of thing that we're longing for and lacking very often in modern sort of atomized wealthy countries. It's also very much the only practical economic answer to the times that we're facing.
Well, as we speak, there is a pandemic threatening the world, but that will pass. But during the novel coronavirus outbreak, experts advise business and schools to switch to work-at-home solutions. And I worry that COVID-19 is merely cementing a trend towards self-isolation already. I mean, we're more attached to our screens instead of human contact, and we have our online friends, but few friends in the real world for many people. What do you feel about that, Sean?
I mean, it does strike me that as these crises are taken in isolation, the advice between the two can overlap. I mean, what are you going to do if you're advised to be in isolation because of a disease outbreak, but at the same time, flooding hits your local community and you're advised to evacuate? I mean, we can't, you know, we can't follow both of those at the same time, and very often the planning for one is faced by a completely different set of organizations and actors than the planning for another. But you're right. I mean, it is another factor that can encourage people to not interact with their friends, their neighbors, their community. But as you say, I think that's something which is likely to pass as previous, well, it's not quite a pandemic yet officially, I believe, but as previous pandemics have. And again, you know, if you are forced to self-isolate, one approach is to do all of your interactions via, I don't know, ordering your food online, etc. Another approach, again, is to have a community, to have people around you who can, you know, maybe they leave it at the door or whatever, but who can actually support and provide the kind of human reassurance and interaction that we need actually a lot more than the purely kind of material things that we can get through the internet economy. So again, you know, for me, the appropriate response to the interlinked crises, the climacteric, as David puts it, is to fall back on the economies that have always supported life and flourishing on Earth, which are firstly the ecology, you know, which we need to defend and rebuild, and secondly, again, the kind of informal economy, the economy of relationships, the economy of the gift.
Well, yes, I think it was in our interview last year where you brought it out that we do know how to live, and we do know how to live without fossil fuels, so we can learn some things from the past.
Absolutely. I mean, my best friend Mark Boyle recently wrote a book called The Way Home, and he's been living for the past 18 months now without electricity, not just off-grid, but without electricity, without running water. And he wrote a line that really struck me, which was, we're often told that this kind of talk is accused of romanticizing the past, but I think the much greater danger is romanticizing the future, and it's the people that are doing that that we need to be really a lot more wary of. You know, if we recognize that the path we've taken is headed for a dead end, there's nothing wrong with going, okay, the path that we've been taking has consequences that we don't want. So what can we learn from the paths we've taken before that maybe didn't have those consequences? There's a line in David Fleming's work that forward motion is not helpful at all when what is needed is a change of direction. And unfortunately, our idea of progress seems to be very strongly limited to a particular kind of progress rather than actually considering the consequences of where that path is leading.
I remember in his book, Discipline and Punish, the French philosopher and historian Michel Foucault wrote about the plague in late medieval times, and there are some lessons there for the present, but he explained that the plague enabled a more coordinated authoritarian state, our modern form of government, as a necessary response to disease. I'm wondering if that could happen again.
Well, I mean, certainly myself, I'm quite familiar with Foucault from having done a philosophy degree, etc., and certainly the existentialists and all of that. But, I mean, really what I took as the thrust of your question was the, you know, the kind of authoritarianism which does thrive on threats. I mean, whether it be pandemic or whether it indeed be, you know, climate change and environmental calamity, there's a real thread in politics of, well, here's a huge problem, so give me all the power and I'll keep you safe. And it can be very tempting when people are feeling lost and afraid to grab hold of that. And really, that's you know, in many ways, again, the essence of David's work and my work and the kind of message we're trying to bring about with this film is that we need to trust in ourselves and each other. You know, ultimately, it's always very tempting to look to some higher power, whether that be a god or a dictator or whatever, to take away our responsibility for dealing things which we're perhaps intimidated by or overwhelmed by. But ultimately, there is no higher thing to appeal to in that way. You know, politicians are people too, and there is no magical mandate that gives them the ability and the insight to know exactly what needs to be done. And indeed, history teaches us. There's a line in David's work, something like, if a member of our family had a decision-making record on a par with the record of government, it would be a kindness to take them into a home. And we really need to trust in our ability as, not so much as individuals, but as communities, as groups of friends, trust in our ability and our own judgment. And really, that's the message of all of our work, is let's believe that we actually know what's needed at the local level. We know what our skills are, what our resources are, what our needs are, and we're far better placed to make the decisions about appropriate courses of action than centralized authorities.
Well, David Fleming, to my mind, earned his reputation as a green economist and an alternative economist, but like Lord Acton, he never published his magnum opus before dying suddenly in 2010. You published it posthumously. How did that become a film? What's the title of the film, and how did that become a film?
Well, the title of the film is the sequel, What Will Follow Our Troubled Civilization? And the story really is that after the books, in fact, came out, so David's magnum opus, as you put it, it's called Lean Logic, A Dictionary for the Future and How to Survive It. And I edited out from that a paperback called Surviving the Future, Culture, Carnival, and Capital in the Aftermath of the Market Economy. Those came out about 3 years ago now. And off the back of that, they've become very popular. I've been leading a number of courses at various colleges based around that work and had people basically get in touch saying that they're really keen to spread this message. So as well as there are three things actually being launched on March 16th. One is the film, which was made by Peter Armstrong, the director, who is, I don't know how well this translates in America, but over here we have BAFTA, which is the British Academy of Film and Television something. And Peter has a Lifetime Achievement Award from them and got in touch with me because he'd been reading Lean Logic and was really keen to sort of translate this message into the film medium. Sterling College in the US in Vermont has developed an online course based around surviving the future, which we're also launching on March 16th. And when I taught a course in, I think, 2017 at Schumacher College in the UK, one of the students there, Matthew Taylor, was very keen to develop an online version of Lean Logic. Because for those who are familiar with it will know it's kind of, David sort of pre-invented Wikipedia, if you like. It's each entry in the dictionary, where there's a word that has its own entry, there's a star next to it. So it's almost like a hyperlinked dictionary. And Matthew was very keen to make it actually a hyperlinked dictionary. And so also we're going to be launching that on March the 16th. So all these different resources have kind of come out of different groups and individuals who've fallen in love with David's writing and his vision for the kind of future we could create together, and have wanted to kind of bring that to different audiences and different mediums. And these have all come to fruition at around the same time.
Is there a website or a Facebook page where our listeners can get up to date and find out what's happening with the sequel?
Yep, it's thesequel.net, and the launch event in London, the sort of central launch event on March 16th, I'll be speaking with Kate Raworth and Rob Hopkins and Caroline Lucas, MP. And that event is now sold out, but it's going to be live-streamed by Extinction Rebellion. So anyone who wants to follow that event, it'll start at around 7 p.m. UK time. And on the main, if you go to thesequel.net, there'll be a link there to the Extinction Rebellion live stream, and there are also sort of viewing events happening in England, Scotland, and the US, which will be showing the film in cinemas and then live streaming the speaker's discussion from London after that. It's all at thesequel.net for all the details.
Right. Well, we do broadcast in London over Resonance FM, so we should be able to get some of your London listeners, but people around the world can just watch the streaming version, and I think that's the way to go. I want to ask you, Sean Chamberlain, what is the relationship between you Extinction Rebellion, and Fleming's Lean Logic?
Well, the relationship between me and Lean Logic is fairly straightforward, as we covered after David passed away. I found his manuscript for that and brought it to posthumous publication with Chelsea Green Publishing. Extinction Rebellion, I was one of the early arrestees back in 2018 when Extinction Rebellion first kicked off, and have been involved since, been in all the rebellions that have taken place here in England. And so I would say that over the past year or so, my main role has been that as Extinction Rebellion has grown and had many, many, many more people get involved with it, I think like any movement, as more people get involved, it becomes sort of diluted in terms of the depth of engagement that the average participant has had with the underlying insights and motivation. So, you know, I'd be out on the street during 2019 with Extinction Rebellion and talking to people, and increasingly I would find that a lot of them might have a more simplistic view of the challenge we face, like, oh, all we need to do is replace fossil fuels with renewable energy, for example, and then, you know, that'll be the problem solved. Whereas I know that a lot of the sort of founders and core people within Extinction Rebellion see it as a much more interconnected, interrelated, climacteric-style problem than that. And so a lot of the work I've been doing has been giving talks to Extinction Rebellion groups about, yes, the kind of scale of the interlinked problems that we face, but also about the sequel. Like, what is it that we're actually demanding? What is it that we actually want here? And using David Fleming's work in Lean Logic as the most beautiful rendering that I've found of that potential of what we're actually striving and working for. And it's been very striking that, I mean, as you know, my work goes under this name of dark optimism, and I find that quite often it can be sort of frustrating when you want to talk to someone about the optimism part. You want to talk to someone about, you know, what it is that we can do in the context of these difficult times to make things better than they would otherwise be. But if people are very new to the darkness, if people are very new to the fundamental ecological and other catastrophic problems that we face, then your initial conversations inevitably end up being about that. And if you actually want to talk about, well, what do we do about them, it can be hard to get past the initial sort of dark night of the soul. And what's been beautiful for me about Extinction Rebellion is that most of the people who are getting involved are very, very familiar with at least a lot of the problems, and are quite often in a place where they're incredibly ready to hear about some kind of story of what we can collectively do to make things better. And also, I think one other thing that's really come out a lot in my work with Extinction Rebellion is that I've, again, not in the kind of founders and spokespeople of Extinction Rebellion, but I think among a lot of the sort of ordinary participants, as you might say, you know, fellow rebels, this kind of sense of kind of disgust at humanity, which is completely understandable when you look at, you know, what's unfolding on the face of the planet. But what I've been really trying to do is drive home this idea that it's not humanity that's the problem per se, because humanity has existed for hundreds of thousands of years without driving catastrophic climate change or causing comparable extinction rates or teetering on the brink of nuclear annihilation. The problem is this culture. There are still human beings living on the planet now who are living in ways that are perfectly compatible with a future. And it can be very dangerous, I think, this idea that humanity is, you know, just a virus or a plague or a cancer or whatever, because it's a very small step from that kind of thinking to self-loathing, to a sense of, you know, oh, well, I should just kill myself because humanity is this kind of evil thing. And I think it's very, very important that we challenge that idea, because the reality is that it's culture that's the problem. Cultures can change a lot faster than genetics can change. And we need to aim our very appropriate disgust at what's unfolding on the face of the planet at the individuals and the institutions and the policies that are sustaining that culture, rather than turning them into, you know, self-hatred, which doesn't lead anywhere useful at all. And so, yeah, really, I've been speaking a lot about this, the powers, what it looks like to live a life of complete rejection of what is an omnicidal culture, but absolutely not a rejection of one's own humanity and power.
Given his desire for a more local, real society, what was Fleming's position on the UK and the EU? Would he have approved of Brexit or of the new nationalist isolationism that's trying to flower in the United States?
It's a very interesting question, and I have to always preface any answer to that question with, you know, obviously I can't authoritatively speak for David, since he's not with us anymore, and this isn't something that we personally discuss. That said, I think there are definite clues in his writing. In the entry Nation in the Logic, he writes, there is a reduced chance in a centralized setting such as that being developed by the European Union of rebuilding a stabilized society from the bottom up. And I would suspect, I personally voted to remain in the European Union, but without strong sense that that was the right vote. I suspect David would have voted to leave, but I think that he, you know, it frustrates me a bit. I don't know how the discourse on this is on your side of the pond, but over here, certainly among sort of green lefties, there's sort of been a sense that anyone who voted for Brexit must have been a deluded idiot or a racist, basically. And I think that does leave out a lot of very understandable motivations. I think that, you know, the desire for more accountable control and more localization, recognition of the economic truth that the unlimited movement of both people and capital does tend to drive down wages for the working class. And I think probably above all, a desire to reclaim a clear identity as a nation, which I think is something that people rightly or wrongly have felt is threatened. I think that these are very understandable motivations, and it's been a big problem that ever since the Brexit vote, which caught most people by surprise, there's been this real drive to separation. I think one of the most beautiful responses to the vote was by a church called St. Ethelburgers, which is actually going to be the host for our launch event next month. And they immediately held open listening days where people, no matter which way they voted, could come together and be invited to go up to the centre and just speak about what they were feeling and what they were thinking, and without anyone responding, just listening so that people could actually understand where different perspectives were coming from. And I think that's, you know, that's what's really been lacking. And what I find most sort of exciting about David Fleming's work is that it's, you know, if Brexit is the path that we're taking, which it now clearly is, then we need to sort of reclaim it from the xenophobes and the racists who do see it as a kind of a vindication. Because while, you know, globalization and neoliberalism are destroying our collective future, but I think the one common factor between votes like Brexit, like Trump, like Bolsonaro, have been this sort of desperate rejection of the establishment and the status quo. I mean, it's really interesting that in this country, all the major parties supported remaining in the European Union. And it was when I realized that was the first time I took seriously the possibility that we might be leaving, because there's such anger at politics at the moment. And again, you were saying before about sort of authoritarianism. It's really important to remember that fascists like Mussolini, like Hitler, they didn't only consolidate power on the basis of lies and fear. They also raised wages, addressed unemployment, improved working conditions. And I think if we are going to avoid what currently looks like a drift towards sort of real fascism, what we need to present is an alternative politico-economic vision that restores identity and pride and economic well-being, like a beautiful story of how we will make the future better for the desperate rather than a fearful one. And for me, that's what's most exciting about David Fleming's work, is that his economics based in trust, in loyalty and local diversity is the most sort of grounded, realistic alternative I've seen to a political future that I have no desire to live through.
I do hear some dark optimism in exactly what you're saying now, but there is a tension between a strong desire for localization and yet a need to deal with global problems, whether it's a pandemic or climate change. Is there a lean logic there to resolve that kind of tension?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably the best known line from David's work is large-scale problems do not require large-scale solutions. They require small-scale solutions within a large-scale framework. And that, I mean, it actually literally changed my life when I first encountered that line, I guess, around 15 years ago. Because at that time, I was thinking about, you know, maybe going to work for the United Nations and work on their climate change policy and stuff like this. And when I encountered that line, it struck me as so true. You know, all the emissions are ultimately coming from localities of one kind or another. But if people just act at the local level, then they become like these, you know, individual atomized drops in the ocean, which are completely overwhelmed by the path of globalization. That's why ever since then, all of my work from being involved with the outset of the Transition Towns movement to the Ecological Land Cooperative. Like, everything that I do has been based on that line of thought. How do we create large-scale frameworks that can unify a diversity of local actions and make them scalable to address large-scale problems? Because, again, it's not large-scale solutions that we need. It's large-scale frameworks that harness a diversity and encourage and stimulate and support a diversity of local responses. And without getting into the whole content of the book, this is absolutely something that David's work draws on very heavily. And that same entry on nation, which I mentioned earlier, ends with the line, the local needs the nation, and talks about the ways in which those kinds of national frameworks can have a healthy relationship with the local and be grounded in that, again, rather than being in opposition to that.
So I'm beginning to see a kind of pathway into your work and into David Fleming's work here, where people might begin with the film, the sequel, because we're very used to visual content, and then go in with your kind of introduction to David's work or summary of it, Surviving the Future. And then we've got this whole dictionary that we can keep referring back to, Lean Logic, a dictionary for the future. Do you think that's a reasonable pathway?
I think that's absolutely spot on. In fact, one reader recently described Lean Logic to me as, they said they think of Lean Logic as almost like an appendix to Surviving the Future. The film is an introduction. Surviving the Future is an incredibly warm and readable and humorous pathway in. And then Lean Logic, yeah, as a kind of reference work to draw on as we do the work, because that's ultimately what it's all about, not sitting and watching films or doing the work. I mean, I heard a line recently, I forget where from, but it was, it's far easier to act our way into new ways of thinking than to think our way into new ways of acting. And I think that's incredibly true. And so I think the important thing is that we start doing something, not just reading and watching. But reading and watching can absolutely be a very helpful way of both inspiring and motivating ourselves and thinking about what we should actually do. But it's very important. And I know for myself, I have a tendency sometimes to get too much into the process of thinking and writing and not so much into the hands-on stuff.
On March 16th, you should be able to stream that presentation by Sean Chamberlain, Carolyn Lucas, and more from the Extinction Rebellion website at rebellion.earth. Also check out darkoptimism.org and Sean's book, Surviving the Future, Culture, Carnival, and Capital in the Aftermath of the Market Economy. That's an even more necessary read now in these precarious times.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.